Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Fiona Hill, the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and co-author of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. We'll discuss how much Putin sees the current crisis with Ukraine through the lens of a former KGB colonel. Then we will speak with a former senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the State Department, David Phillips, who has an article at the Huffington Post, Putin's Calculus in Ukraine. We will discuss concerns expressed by Russian-speaking Angela Merkel after a long phone conversation with German-speaking Vladimir Putin that the Russian leader is in his own world, believing that Russia's problems with Ukraine are caused by CIA and U.S. meddling, not a rejection of Russia's corrupt and criminal model of governance personified by the deposed Yanukovych family regime. Then finally, we will hear from Toby Miller, one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to everyday life. We will discuss this year's winners in the Academy Awards that seem to reject politically themed documentaries like The Square and Dirty Wars, and movies with political and social content like American Hustle, The Wolf of Wall Street, and Nebraska, in favor of a special effects-driven Gravity. And joining us now is Fiona Hill, director of the Center on the United States and Europe and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. She is a frequent commentator on Russia and Ukrainian affairs and Eurasian affairs and has researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy and strategic issues. She's also the co-author of the new book, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fiona Hill.
Thanks, Ian.
And what is your sense then of the extent to which Vladimir Putin sees what's happening in the Ukraine through this lens of a former KGB colonel? And what I'm told by Russians that I've spoken to is that he honestly believes that this is all the work of the CIA and not a rejection of this model of governance personified by the Yanukovych regime.
I think it's actually the case that Vladimir Putin has believed for a very long time that many of the conflicts and upheavals in the former Soviet Union have been managed and instigated from the outside. It's not just the situation in Ukraine right now over the last several weeks and months, but it's also the so-called color revolutions that took place in Georgia, Ukraine, and to some extent Kyrgyzstan in the earlier parts of the 2000s. And Putin's approach to this has obviously been very much shaped by his worldview and his experience in the KGB at a time when, indeed, as we know, during the Cold War, the CIA was engaged in a certain amount of subterfuge and subtervention, and indeed in a certain amount of intervention in other countries' political situations and in different conflicts. So Putin has just assumed that state of affairs has continued, and in part that's probably heightened by the continuation of the intelligence, counterintelligence interactions between Russia and the United States. And we've had a lot over the last several years about spying, mutual spying. Obviously, Vladimir Putin has in his possession right now Edward Snowden, who's been making all these revelations about the NSA, and that can only have fueled Putin's perception of what the United States is up to. And then there's been all of the back and forth on sleeper agents and various efforts at recruitment. You remember that Putin unmasked a bunch of British spies in Moscow who were engaging in dead drops and relished that. So for as far as he's concerned, nothing has really changed. And when he looks at Ukraine and he looks at developments in Georgia or in any of the other countries in the region, he sees the long and very heavy hand of the United States and the CIA and generally of Western intelligence meddling in his neighborhood.
Well, I know a lot of people on the left think that the CIA is behind everything. But in the real world, intelligence agencies, this may not apply to Russia because it's run by a former intelligence agent, and most of the cronies that are running the place seem to be former KGB people. But the intelligence agencies don't have that much influence over the bigger issues of the economy, geopolitics, and governance. And I'm wondering whether even with the case of John Kerry going to Kiev, that strikes me as being something of a mistake. Why didn't he go straight to Moscow? I mean, why can't we find ways to? I mean, I believe Angela Merkel tried to counsel Putin in that long conversation that it's, you know, that the CIA is not out to, they're not behind everything. But why do you think Kerry's? I mean, do you think that Kerry showing up in Kiev is just going to inflame the situation in Putin's eyes?
Well, it could well do that. I mean, right now we've got to figure out how do we address this paranoia and this high level of distrust that Putin has towards us and to the world, the West in general. I don't think he is per se anti-American or anti-Western, but he does perceive a real threat. And you actually said something very important there, Ian. I mean, Putin is pretty unique in the whole realm of world leaders right now. He is the only person who has come from the shadows as an operative from the organs of the state that were really beyond the scrutiny and beyond the oversight of politicians or of the public. There is no one else like him out there at the top of a government. And he then brings this particular worldview to things, and we also, ourselves, don't understand how to address that. I mean, Angela Merkel, for one, comes from East Germany, where she was basically subject to the intervention, the subterfuge, and the manipulation of the Stasi. She and her family suffered, like many other East Germans, from that overbearing police state and the role of the intelligence services there. And she probably, although she understands the general mindset, she can't quite reach Putin on that particular level. I mean, Putin, when he looks around the world, I mean, again, he really does seem to think that the institutions that we have oversight over in the West, that are actually open there, especially, as I say, the situation with Edward Snowden must really have encouraged this thinking on his part even more, that they're really behind the scenes call the shots. And in a way, that's also mirror imaging because, as you've pointed out, he has a very tight, informal network of people around him actually do run Russia. It's not the state institutions that do so, and many of them do have a security service background. So we have to really understand his worldview, but unfortunately, the paranoia and this distrust that we have is not easily addressed, and it's going to take an awful lot of work on the part of the Germans, on the part of many of our leaders overall to try to dispel this, but it's going to be a very, very difficult situation.
And again, I'm speaking with Fiona Hill, who's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution. She's a frequent commentator on Russian and Eurasian affairs, who has researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy and strategic issues. She's also the co-author of the new book, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. But already, the markets have, Russian stocks have taken a beating. They've lost about $60 billion in stock value just in the course of a day, which is more than what the Sochi Olympics cost. Gazprom has lost $15 billion in one day, which is the same amount that Putin had pledged to Yanukovych. Is that getting through to Putin, do you think?
Well, again, very sadly, whenever things like this happen, there's also a tendency coming out of the Kremlin to accuse the West of, you know, somehow trying to subvert the Russian economy. And, of course, all the discussion that we're having here about sanctions, and frankly, you know, sanctions would have an impact on Russia and on the Russian economy if they were the kind of sanctions that we've imposed against Iran, where we, you know, we've stood in lockstep together with the EU, and those sanctions have had a big impact on certainly the Iranian economy and to some degree on the sentiment of you know, the Ukrainian leadership in deciding to go again for a negotiation with the West. But, you know, from the Russian point of view, this is all the effects of punitive action. This is double standards. This is something that we're doing again to try to subvert Russia from the inside. And we were really in a very delicate situation here. The Russians perceive a real threat from the developments in Ukraine. And Putin is the kind of person who finds it very, very hard to believe that these are spontaneous, you know, grassroots developments. I think he's also brought in the narrative that the people around him have been spinning about extremist neo-Nazi factions who are orchestrating all of this, about the fact it's a coup that was perpetrated against Yanukovych. And he doesn't see at all that this is, you know, really the expression of a vast swathe of the Ukrainian population of protest against the way that the country was being governed. Again, he thinks that people were paid to go out onto the square in the streets of Kiev to protest and to overthrow the government. He doesn't believe that people spontaneously organize themselves and, you know, raise money themselves through sort of crowdsourcing to be there. And there's many people in Russia who share that same conspiracy theory, and as you've pointed out, many people here who also believe the same thing. I've heard the same comments from Putin passed around by Western observers, you know, as I've been out and about today.
So, given how much the propaganda machinery that Putin runs in Russia has demonized what's happening, or demonized the opposition, who are now a government, even though they seem to be in a state of shock. And I spoke yesterday with an independent defense analyst in Moscow, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who took the position that Putin was kind of a czar, acting imperiously and recklessly, and that that in the short term he may be able to cower that country, but in the other, in the long term, it could have some grave consequences. That the Ukrainians do feel strongly and are very nationalistic. And my understanding is that even inside Russia, the, what polling is available, apparently the Russian people, even though they've been propagandized, they're not apparently thrilled with the idea of war.
No, I mean, there's nobody in the Russian setting who would have any support whatsoever for a war with Ukraine. Ukraine's a very different matter from Georgia. I mean, one of the difficulties we have here, that the narrative that's coming out of Moscow is talking about the fraternal people of Ukraine. They're even Putin has actually even said we're one and the same nation. And, you know, this is obviously based on the Russian language acquisition of a, you know, very large swathe of the population in Ukraine. But we know from many other settings that just because you speak a certain language doesn't necessarily you mean that you identify with the larger group that that language belongs to. I mean, there are many places across the world that speak English, but, you know, have a very different set of identity. Scotland is, you know, a case in point, but, you know, we'll see what happens with the Scottish referendum in September. So the calculation that all Russian speakers in Ukraine, or the vast majority of them, are somehow in favor of being joined with Russia has to be put to the test. And if indeed that leads, as Dr. Felgenhauer was suggesting, in the direction of an open conflict, and that shots are fired on the part of Ukrainians and Russians in a conflict with each other, that will change public sentiment quite dramatically in Russia. Right now, Putin is benefiting from an uptick in his popularity and his poll ratings as a result of Sochi. He knows that everybody on the outside doesn't want to have a conflict over Ukraine and is in a considerable state of disarray. He's taking advantage of the fact that the Ukrainians haven't held an election for a new government. And so right now they're in a way ungoverned, and they're cobbling together basically an acting administration until elections can be held for a new president. And he's playing with the fact that President Yanukovych, the deposed president of Ukraine, is now in Russia, and they can, you know, use Yanukovych's presence to also justify and legitimize, at least in public opinion at home and, you know, perhaps to some degree elsewhere, the actions that they're taking in defense of the legitimately or the legally elected government of Ukraine that was overturned and is represented by Yanukovych. So, I mean, there's a lot going on here. There's a great deal of complexity. There's a great deal of uncertainty. And I think, again, Pavel Felgenhauer is right that, you know, Russia and Putin in particular cannot guarantee that they can be in complete control of events and of sentiment on the ground in Ukraine as we go forward. And this could have some blowback and some repercussions for Putin at home.
Well, already the UN, Russia's UN representative has held up a letter to the Security Council from Yanukovych saying that he's asked for Russian military intervention in Ukraine.
Well, exactly. And I think that's kind of part of the problem that we're facing. And Putin also went to the Federation Council, the upper house of the Russian parliament, and essentially got a blanket approval, in effect, really mirroring what President Obama was trying to do in terms of putting the situation in Syria to a vote to the houses of Congress and the Senate in the United States, you know, so many months ago. But this time, Putin was pretty sure that he was going to get approval, and he got it, essentially justifying taking some form of action in defense of Russian speakers and Russian citizens across the whole territory of Ukraine. So, you know, opened up the possibility of moving beyond Crimea to some other points, at least in Ukraine. And the speculation right now is that it may be in some of these cities with a predominantly Russian-speaking population, like Donetsk or Kharkiv, which are in the far eastern part of Ukraine.
Well, but the evidence of Ukrainians, I mean, the best evidence, and it's and is about this idea of overturning Yanukovych's decree about Russian language speaking, and which the new government, even though it's not even really a government, have subsequently rescinded. That's the only evidence of any anti-Russian discrimination. The people who are being beaten up are Ukrainians who are opposing Russian intervention, and the people who have been shot have been Ukrainians who've been shot by their own government. So as far as I can tell, there's no evidence of discrimination against Russian speakers, and the logic by which Putin is operating, which is I have to defend Russian minorities, could extend to the Baltics and throughout the entire former Soviet Union.
Well, this is also a line that was used prior to Putin. It's actually been a long-standing policy of the Russian government since the Yeltsin period, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, back in 1991, to exert the right to protect the interests of Russian speakers, not just of Russian citizens in the neighboring countries. It was indeed, as you point out, a factor in the Baltic states throughout the whole of the 1990s, but also in places like Transnistria, the secessionist republic of Moldova, in Abkhazia, in South Ossetia, you know, the secessionist republics of Georgia, and again in Ukraine. We've been living with this for an awfully long time. It was back actually in 1992 when Russia first started to assert that right to basically protect the interests of Russian speakers. So Putin is playing along here on a very long-standing practice, Russian insistence on the legality of the Russian language. And there are many parts of the former Soviet Union, including Kazakhstan, many of the countries with the large Russian-speaking populations that have played backwards and forwards with various language decrees. As you said, it was only Yanukovych who introduced this language ruling quite recently, in fact, to curry favor with the Russian-speaking population in the east of Ukraine. But it's also, again, not just a divisive issue, but also something that's very misleading, because there's a huge swathe of the Ukrainian population of people who think of themselves as ethnically Ukrainian who speak Russian. I mean, if you go to Kiev, you hear Russian spoken just as much as you hear Ukrainian. I have many friends who are Ukrainian who speak only Russian. And also, you know, Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainian friends who say that they spend all of their days speaking Russian. So this is, in many respects, a red herring issue. It's used deliberately for the process of political manipulation.
But you mentioned Kazakhstan, which is a part of this union that Putin is offering in competition to the EU, and which is began this whole zero sum situation with Ukraine. The foreign minister of Kazakhstan says Kazakhstan expresses deep concern over the developments in Ukraine and calls on all sides to stop the use of force in the resolution of this situation. It doesn't sound like Kazakhstan is too thrilled about what's happening.
No, they shouldn't be, because, I mean, the extension of the logical extension of what's happening in Ukraine could soon be visited in Kazakhstan. The president of Kazakhstan, Nursultan Nazarbayev, is getting older. Everybody's focusing on what comes next after Nursultan Nazarbayev. So there must be great concern in Astana, the capital of Kazakhstan right now, about what Russia will do if they don't like the regime, the administration, the government, or the leader who succeeds Nazarbayev. Will they then claim the same right to protect Russian speakers and Russian citizens in Kazakhstan? And the whole part of northern Kazakhstan was settled not just by Russians, but Ukrainians, Belarusians, a whole host of people from around the Soviet Union. It's part of the old virgin lands that were settled under Khrushchev period, and the people there are predominantly Russian-speaking. A large part of the Kazakh elite only speaks Russian. So the point is, a lot of people will be wondering, where does this stop? And even if our relationships with Russia are good now, how far is Vladimir Putin and others going to push things if they don't like the turn of events on the ground in our republic as well?
Well, just in closing, Fiona Hill, I was quite alarmed by what Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer said yesterday. And are you worried that this could get out of hand?
Well, there's always a risk on every side for miscalculation. I mean, we run the same risks ourselves. I mean, we're basically, as we started off at the very beginning, dealing with someone who has a very different worldview from our own, one that isn't always understood. We don't have the same frame of reference when we talk about the same concerns and the same sets of issues. And in that case, the whole propensity and the whole tendency towards misunderstanding has already been made very clear. And Vladimir Putin and the people around him have also made it extremely evident that they see what was happening in Ukraine on the ground as a real risk, as a real threat to them and a threat to their interests, and that they've been prepared to take some fairly drastic action in the defense of those interests. And so we're not going to see Putin back down. He's not the kind of person who backs down. I think we're going to be in here for the long haul, and we're going to be dealing with a situation in Crimea and in other parts of eastern Ukraine that's going to unfold very rapidly and is going to be a massive challenge for us for the foreseeable future. And it's going to greatly complicate every effort that we've been having to find a way of dealing with Russia directly.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Fiona Hill.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Fiona Hill, who's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution. She's a frequent commentator on Russian and Eurasian affairs who has researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy and strategic issues. She's also the co-author of the new book, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into Putin's calculus in Ukraine.